and they were only too happy to stick it to the riders. I listened quietly. Roshan had never mentioned any of this.
Look, I'm not proud of it, yeah? Tremaine mutters. It doesn't mean I think I was right. It's just what happened.
And you never cleared the air with Roshan? I ask.
Couldn't bring myself to. Now it feels too late.
I can't help but think back to how I'd clutched my head in my hands the night I'd glitched myself into the Warcross opening ceremony, completely unaware that my world was about to change forever. Everything became amazing. Then everything turned awful. Life is always like that. You don't know when you'll suddenly claw your way out of your circumstances, or when you'll go crashing back down into them. I'm not going to tell you it's never too late, I reply. But in my experience, it's always the not doing that I regret more. The rain has stopped now, and the puddles in the alleyway have turned into undisturbed mirrors. Tremaine's the first to push away from the wall. He shoves his hands into his pockets, then glances at me over his shoulder. Whatever vulnerabilities he'd shown a second ago have vanished behind his cool exterior.
So, he says, his bravado back. No chance you're quitting, huh?
I shake my head. Afraid not.
Well,
he lingers for a moment, nodding out toward the main streets.
Then we'll need to stop fooling around in virtual reality and head to the Institute for ourselves.
I look quickly at him. What do you mean, we? I thought you were out either way. He sends me a message, and a map appears in my view with a blinking red cursor hovering over a place somewhere beyond the northern fringes of Tokyo. Japan Innovation Institute of Technology, the cursor says. Saitama-ken, Japan.
If you're going to continue, then I guess I'll stick it out with you.
He points to the map.
When I went, all I could do was observe the campus from the outside. But I'm sure there's plenty more going on behind those closed doors than what I could glean from their servers or their front gates. We'll need to head in at night, when there aren't so many guards.
I stare at the map, my fingers tingling. This is where Hideo's mother had worked, and where Sasuke may have spent his childhood. From the map, it doesn't look like much. A building of glass and steel. A single structure in a sea of thousands. How can one place hold so many secrets?
So tomorrow night, he says.
I give him a half smile. Done. He heads out into the alley. His emotions are packed away again, but his usual sneer is now replaced with something more open.
See you soon, Princess Peach, he replies.
This time, the nickname sounds affectionate.
And keep yourself safe until then.
The hotel where the Blackcoats are staying is quiet tonight, and I'm the only one walking down its halls. I sigh as the door identifies me and lets me in. My mind is a whirlwind of clues and questions. What if the Institute has covered its tracks? What if I can't find anything? There's not much time before the closing ceremony, and I still know so little about Zero. Where is he tonight anyway? The instant I close the door to my room, I know something is off. There's the faint scent of perfume in the air, and a lamp on the far end of the room is turned on.
Out late, someone says.
I whirl around to see Taylor waiting for me. Chapter 14. I freeze at the sight of her silhouette, sitting casually in my chair. One of her legs crossed over the other. Weak light from the windows cuts a striped pattern against her. Even from the other side of the room, I can see her eyes in the shadows, studying me. She's perfectly groomed, her hair combed neatly back, and her outfit is sleek and monochromatic,
blacks and grays. I find myself unconsciously comparing her to the photo I'd seen earlier of her in front of the Institute.
"We heard you were out celebrating with the Phoenix Riders tonight," she says. "Congratulations to your former team."
Jax had trailed me after all. I fight the urge to look around to see if she's standing in here right now, somewhere I hadn't noticed. "I don't need you guys to chaperone me all over the city." Taylor uncrosses her legs, the sole of her shoe hitting the carpet with a soft thud, and leans forward to rest her elbows against her knees. Her eyes meet mine and lock me in.
"Where were you?"
So, she doesn't trust me.
"I was out on the mission that you and Zero assigned to me," I reply evenly. "Find a way to get in touch with Hideo? That's what you want, isn't it?"
She frowns.
"And did you accomplish anything?"
I take a deep breath. "The Riders are going to let me use their private meeting with Hideo tomorrow."
"Is that so?"
At that, Taylor's eyebrows lift in mild surprise.
"Well, maybe you are as good as Zero says."
"I always earn my keep."
"And is that all you did tonight?"
Here's the real question she'd wanted to ask me, and why she was waiting for me here in my room.
"Be careful out there." Tremaine's warning reappears in my mind. I narrow my eyes at her.
"What are you saying?"
"I'm saying that someone accessed the Black Coat's image databases today, and it wasn't any of us."
She studies me.
"The timing makes me wonder if you know something about it."
"Image databases. Japan Innovation Institute of Technology." My heart leaps into my throat. Tremaine had been poking around in the corporation's database earlier. I think of the maps he'd shown me, the interiors of the building. Is Taylor talking about him? What if he'd accidentally left a trail? Does she know what he took? "Stay calm," I tell myself.
"It couldn't have been me," I reply. "I didn't do anything except meet the Phoenix Riders after tonight's game and have a conversation with them. No downloading, no hacking."
She stares at me, but I don't dare add more. The crow's feet at the corners of her eyes crinkle as she studies me thoughtfully. A few long minutes pass. Then, her stare softens, and she relaxes her shoulders. She glances toward the windows.
"If Zero suspected you of breaking into our files, he would be here himself, interrogating you. And he wouldn't be this civil about it."
The thought sends a chill through me. "Then why are you here instead?"
"I'm here to warn you,"
she replies, giving me a concerned look.
"You don't want to get in over your head."
"But I didn't do anything." She looks doubtful. There's a pause, and then she clears her throat.
"How old were you when you first started bounty hunting?"
she finally asks. 16. She shakes her head.
"I was young too, when I started my first job. Back then, we lived in Estonia, and my father laundered money using the pharmacy he ran as a front. Drugs, you know."
I watch her carefully. It shouldn't surprise me that she had early ties to something illegal, given that she's working for the Black Coats. But I must look startled by her answer, because she gives me a small laugh.
"Ha, that surprises you. I don't seem like the type, do I?"
She looks down.
"I was sharp for my age, and I could repeat things back, word for word, so my father had me run messages for him."
She makes a casual gesture with her arm, miming a back-and-forth action.
"You don't want digital messages lying around on phones to incriminate you. I could say what I was told to say, and then forget it the second I said it. He told me I had a good memory, that it's useful for lies."
She shrugs.
"But he wasn't as good at it as I was."
I clear my throat. "What makes you say that?"
I came home one day to see him sprawled on the floor, his throat cut and his blood soaked into our rugs. That copper smell still lingers with me.
The curve of her lips straightens, like she bit into something bitter. I shudder.
Later, I learned that a client of his had come looking for him, and he'd tried to lie his way out of it. The client hadn't believed him.
I swallow hard. Taylor doesn't look at me as she continues.
After that, all I ever did was wonder about how the wires in my brain were hooked up. How those wires stop working the instant your body shuts down. I'd wake up in the middle of the night in a cold sweat, dreaming of being alive one moment and then dead the next.
She sounds like I imagine a neuroscientist would, someone fascinated with the inner workings of the mind. Had she moved to Japan to work at the Institute? I try to picture her as a child with wide eyes and those straight, innocent brows. The thought of her getting away with lies so often seems pretty possible.
Why are you telling me this? I ask.
I could convince myself of a lie so well that I'd sincerely think it was true. Do you know what that's called? Self-deception, Emika. Lies are told more easily when you don't see them as lies. My father said he wished he had my ability to believe wholeheartedly in something untrue, because if you're able to believe anything, then you can believe your way into happiness. That's why I'm alive and he's dead. Because my brain could connect that wire, and his couldn't.
She leans forward, looking earnestly at me.
Maybe you're good at it too. I imagine it's a useful skill for a bounty hunter.
Stay calm.
I'm not lying to you, I tell her in a firm voice this time. I didn't hack into any black coat databases. I wouldn't even know where to look.
Then you have nothing to worry about, Taylor agrees.
Her voice sounds genuine, and her expression looks genuine. But I stay wary, waiting for her to make some unexpected move.
What did you work on at the Institute? And what exactly do you do for the Black Coats?
I hope you understand how important your role is.
Taylor gives me a nod before she rises from my chair and straightens her blouse. She nods toward the streetlights outside the window.
Look.
Two new virtual figures appear to hover underneath each light, followed by a wave of cheers and boos from the revelers on the street. I recognize my own rainbow hair instantly. Ivo Eriksson of Sweden, Andromeda. Amika Chen of USA. Phoenix Writers. At the same time, a message pops up front and center in my view. Congratulations, Amika Chen. You have been chosen as a top 10 player of the Warcross Championships 8. Taylor smiles at my stunned expression.
You're the only one chosen so far by write-in votes alone, she says.
Very impressive. As she walks past me, she says something in a voice just loud enough for me to hear.
I won't tell Zero about our conversation, but let this be the last time we need to have one. I think you owe it to all your fans to perform well at the closing ceremony.
Then she's gone, leaving me standing in the middle of my room alone with all my questions. Chapter 15. 3 days until the Warcross closing ceremony. The few hours of sleep that I managed to get are plagued by nightmares. Visions of myself standing in an arena, a woman sitting in my chair, a girl with short silver hair training her gun on me. Hideo pulling me close in a bedroom made of glass. I dream of Tremaine leaning against the wall at the Innovation Institute and watching the rain. That's what finally shakes me awake, the image of him standing there, unaware of someone watching him in the shadows. I jerk upright in bed, mumbling his name, trying in vain to warn him. By the time I meet the riders at Asher's place, I'm an exhausted mess, with dark circles prominent under my eyes. Secretly, I count my blessings that at least the event I'm attending requires makeup and formal wear, so that I don't show up looking like a ghost. Asher answers the door.
You look terrible, he says,
leaning one elbow against his chair. You too, I reply. He flashes me a grin before ushering me inside.
Well, Hammy's going to do something about that.
Hammy's already here and waiting for me. She takes my hand and leads me to Asher's bedroom, where she shuts the two of us in and pulls me over to the closet. I find myself staring at a small rack of dresses. I did a little shopping, she says, holding one of the dresses up against me. She squints an eye shut. These look about your size. I'm quiet as I change out of my clothes and slip on the first dress. It's Givenchy, a shimmering sea of midnight fabrics that hugs my hips. Hammy studies me with a thoughtful frown. It fits a little weird up here, she says, tapping my shoulder. She turns to grab another dress. Let's try a Giambattista Valli. Give you some volume. She holds up a beautiful fluffy poof of a gown in pale champagne pink. I stare at myself, drowning behind layers of tulle, and imagine what it will be like to see Hideo in person again. Maybe this is a bad idea, I start to say. You're right, Hammy ponders out loud, hanging the dress back on the rack. Too much poof. How about a Dior? No, I mean... I take a deep breath and close my eyes. Hideo, this isn't going to go well. Hammy pauses to look at me as she holds up a new ball gown with a bold black and white print. You're afraid to see him, aren't you? My eyes meet Hammy's in the mirror. You didn't see the look in his eyes when we last talked. He's not going to hear me out. More likely, he'll have his bodyguards on me the instant he knows I'm at the party. Hammy doesn't deny it, and I'm almost grateful she doesn't try to console me with any lies. Listen, she replies instead. One time, my mom and dad had an argument before New Year's. I don't remember what it was over. Walking our dog, something dumb. Anyway, they both decided regardless to go separately to their friend's New Year's Eve party. I went with my dad. When we got there, my dad saw my mom, sparkling in the most gorgeous silver gown you've ever seen in your life. Know what he did? He walked right up to her, said he was sorry, and then they kissed over and over and over. It was disgusting. I give Hammy a withering look. That's different. Your parents are in love, and they weren't fighting over the fact that your dad wants to control the world. Hammy waves a flippant hand. Details. I'm just saying. You think you're not over Hideo? He's mad about you. You heard Ken say it. Even Zero knows. And now the girl he can't get out of his head is going to show up right in front of him without warning in a stunning dress? You're going to knock his socks off with a battering ram. Well, I'm glad one of us thinks so. I pull on a new dress and adjust the straps. This one fits like a glove, with a plunging back and a full skirt ending perfectly at my feet. I don't think being unpredictable is a good thing with Hideo, I say. Everything about you has been unpredictable since the moment you hacked into his game. Hammy steps back, admiring the dress's clean lines. If he doesn't at least give you the time of day when he sees you like this, he really has no soul. Then you can kick his ass. We pause at a knock on the door. Hammy calls out that we're done, and it opens to reveal Roshan, leaning against the doorway. He glances over at me with an approving look. Kaz here, he says. Give us a sec, Hammy replies, while I do her hair and makeup. The world is hanging by a thread, and yet here the riders still are, acting like this is nothing more than getting me ready for a party. I feel an overwhelming rush of gratitude for them. Hideo's going to know you all helped me, I say to Roshan.
You don't need to worry about us right now, Roshan replies.
He meets my gaze with his steady one.
Just be careful.
I close my eyes as Hammy starts dusting glittering shadow on my eyelids. It's just as well. Tremaine's story about their past is still fresh in my mind, and looking at Roshan's unsuspecting face sends an ache through my chest. Finally, I'm ready. As I head out of the house, I hear Hammy call out one last good luck in my direction. Then I'm getting into the car, and the door seals me in. I spend the entire ride with my hands clasped tightly in my lap, mossed in the silken folds of my dress's skirt. Beyond the window, high-rises blur by with little shrines squeezed between them, followed by garden walls and an expansive park. The sun is already setting, and more neon lights are starting to turn on. As we drive alongside a river that reflects the subways running on the opposite side of the banks, I can see the interior of the train cars packed with people, many of them decked out in their Warcross virtual outfits. Too anxious already, I force myself to look away, then concentrate on overlaying a randomly generated face on my own. My rainbow hair turns into sleek dark brown, and my eyes change to a pale hazel. When I see my reflection again in the car's rearview mirrors, I look unrecognizable. I don't need to tell him much tonight, I remind myself. Right now, I just need to convince the Black Coats that I'm making progress in getting closer to Hideo. I need Hideo to agree to meet me again in private, so that I can talk to him safely. He's mad about you, I try to repeat Hammy's reassurances to myself. But it's harder to believe without her beside me. The drive feels both like it took forever and no time at all. The Tokyo Museum of Contemporary Art's main entrance is entirely blocked off today, thick with security. But my car takes a turn into a smaller side entrance that brings us through the surrounding park grounds. We go up the winding path a brief distance before stopping on the side of the building. Here it's quieter, a few other black cars ahead of us. I hold my breath as we reach the front of the line. Here, the car comes to a full stop at the entrance, and its door slides open.
Have a wonderful evening, the car says. Congratulations again on your team's win.
Thank you, I mutter at it before I exit, fanning out my dress. Everyone else inside the building is decked out in elaborate attire. Some of them are wearing half-masks adorned with jewel-encrusted feathers, while others hold delicate, porcelain-colored fans across their faces. I stand there for a moment, feeling at once vulnerable and invisible. Thank goodness Hammy forced me to choose such an elegant dress. Anything less would have made me stand out in this crowd. The main entrance hall of the museum is a soaring corridor of glass and metal, enormous triangles cut through with a steel mesh of circles. The giant glass panels are actually screens, and as I walk, the Neuralink simulates scenes on each panel from this year's championship worlds. I recognize the rematch's world of cloud, plains, and cliffs. Then the ice world of my first official game. I pause for a moment in front of a panel showcasing the eerie underwater ruins that we'd played in the Rider's third round. This was the world where Zero had broken into my account and made me his offer. All around me, groups of social elites cluster and laugh politely over conversations I can't understand. I see women drenched in jewels, men in sharply tailored suits and tuxedos. Asher had said these people would be the upper crust of society. Billionaires and philanthropists, the kind of people Hideo must constantly cross paths with. Then, finally, I reach the end of the hall, where I spot who I've been searching for. Every muscle in my body tenses at the same time. Hideo's standing there with a small circle of his bodyguards, each of them dressed in matching black suits. And he's deep in conversation with several other well-dressed people. Ken, Mari is here too, in a long-sleeved silver dress with a sheer tulle train. There's a young woman about my age who's leaning into Hideo, laughing at something he's just said. I try not to pay attention to how beautiful she is. A few others, women and businessmen alike, wait on the sidelines for their chance to talk to him. At least Asher was right about this setting. If Hideo sees me here, he's not going to want to cause a scene. There have been enough disruptions during this year's championships, and too many elite folks are here. But if he doesn't want me to cause a scene, he'll have to agree to talk to me. As I watch him politely field the girl's questions, I gradually start to dissolve the anonymous virtual face I've overlaid over my own, erasing it so that only Hideo will be able to see behind it. Then I step forward until there's no one before me except him and the girl. He glances in my direction, then he freezes. His distant expression vanishes, and for an instant, all I can see beneath it is a look of shock. Beside him, the girl touching his arm looks in my direction and gives me a confused scowl. To her, I still look like some stranger, someone she doesn't know, and she lets out a nervous laugh.
"Who's this, Hideo?" she says.
One of the bodyguards must sense Hideo's sudden change in demeanor, too, because I see his hand fly to his gun. I instinctively brace myself. I've made a mistake. I've misjudged this event. Hideo's going to let his guard take me down. He doesn't care about making a scene here, no matter how many powerful people are at this party. But then, Hideo holds up a warning hand at the guard. He meets the man's eyes and shakes his head once. "Excuse me," he says to the girl at his side, then takes a few steps toward me. He gives me a polite bow of his head, and I return the gesture. "It's been a long time since I've seen you," he says. He takes my hand and presses it once to his lips. Behind him, the girl he'd been with sucks in her breath and exchanges a quick look with a friend. The conversation around us turns quiet. His mind must be spinning right now. He must be wondering how I got in here, whether the Phoenix Riders are in on whatever my plans are. On the surface, though, I just smile back and play along, as if everything were fine. "Well, is that my fault or yours?" He turns briefly to his other guests, all of whom are staring at us with obvious interest. "My apologies," he says. His eyes go to his bodyguards. "Stay here. I won't be long." Without waiting to hear their responses, he turns to me and places one hand at the small of my back. I try to ignore the sensation that the only thing separating us is the silky fabric of this dress. His expression is tired, and I wonder if he's learned anything new about the bug in the algorithm since I eavesdropped on his conversation. He doesn't seem like he trusts me, but for some reason, he still nods and steers us through the hall until it branches into the museum's interior, where one corridor leads out into a vast courtyard. There's a slight chill in the night air, and the grounds are sparsely populated with only a few people here and there. Trees line the sides of a towering structure that curves up to the evening sky. Other art installations look like they're dedicated specifically to Warcross. One series of 3D sculptures forms the Warcross logo from certain angles, and from other angles looks like an artifact, or a popular virtual item, or the outfit of an official player. Another piece of art is a stylized interpretation of the various worlds used in this year's championships, a series of white polygons in a row, representing the ice columns from the white world I'd played in, or modern art ruins of a city encased behind a giant glass cube tinted an underwater green color. Yet another looks like a real-life ode to Warcross's virtual reality realms, dozens of giant, round lights installed in the ground so that each shoots a colored beam up toward the sky. Orchestral music plays softly, changing whenever we step onto one of the light columns, matching each color to a different musical cue. As we walk through them, we cast shadows haloed in the color of that column of light. The mood would feel almost peaceful if it weren't for the reason we're out here. Now Hideo leads us close to the light installation. Blue and yellow beams cast their colors against his skin.
"Where are we going?" I say.
Hideo's gaze turns dark. "I'm escorting you out," he says in a low voice. I'm not surprised by his words, but they still hit me hard. He doesn't speculate about the fact that I'd clearly gotten help from the riders, or that I might be here to hurt him. He just looks at me, like I'm nothing more than some distant associate that he'd already forgotten. I can feel my cheeks warming, my heartbeat beginning to race. It's stupid of me to still be bothered by him, but I can't force the sting down. It makes me think that maybe I'd always read him wrong. Unless he's afraid of me being here. Maybe he's afraid that I've been sent here after him. And he'd be right. "Please," I respond before I can think through my words. "Just hear me out. I'm not here to argue with you. Neither of us has the time for that."
"What are you doing here, Amika?"
Hideo says with a sigh. He glances briefly toward the bright museum hall, the impatience obvious in his glare. I swallow hard, and then take a step onto one of the light columns. Yellow light illuminates everything around me, and the music shifts to an active orchestral piece. Hideo follows me.
"I've found something you need to know," I say, my words shielded from any prying ears by the music.
From a distance, it looks like we're just two people enjoying the art installation. I hold my breath, ready for Hideo to call for his guards. He doesn't. He studies my expression, as if searching for what I might say next.
"Tell me," he says.
I take another step onto a different light column. This time, I'm bathed in blue, and the music shifts to a deeper track. The words sit at the tip of my tongue. "Your brother is Zero, the same hacker we'd been tracking throughout the championships. Once he knows, there's no turning back."
"I'll show you instead," I reply.
Then I bring up an image of Zero without his armor, his face exposed and unmistakable. The image hovers between us. It's as if I'd struck Hideo straight in the chest. He doesn't move, doesn't breathe, doesn't blink. The color drains from his face. In the blue light, his skin takes on an ominous glow from below, and his eyes look like black marbles. His lips tighten. His hands move slightly, and when I look down at them, he's balled both into fists so tightly that his scarred knuckles have turned white. His stare never leaves Sasuke's face, one that looks so similar to his own. He scrutinizes everything, the way his eyes turn sideways, the thoughtful tilt of his head, the hardness of his smile. Maybe he's making a mental list of all the ways the two of them are alike, or maybe he's matching up these features with what he remembers of Sasuke as a child, as if he'd drawn a new image in his head with these two pictures combined. Then his eyes shudder. Whatever he thinks of the photo disappears behind a cloud of disbelief. He turns to me.
"This has to be fake. You're lying to me."
"I've never been more truthful." I keep my words steady and the image unwavering. He straightens and takes a step away from me so that half of him is in a red column of light. "This photo isn't real. That isn't him."
"It's real. I swear it on my life."
The anger on his face is growing every second, a wall breaking in the part of him that had believed me. Still, I stay where I am, digging my nails into the palms of my hands.
"I've met your brother."
Then I join him on the red light as I continue, slower and more forcefully this time. "I don't know everything about him yet. and I can't tell you everything here. But I saw him with my own eyes. I've spoken with him directly. Zero is your brother. You're baiting me.
There, in his voice, I hear it. The tiniest hint of doubt. A delay long enough to tell me that I may be getting through to him.
I'm not, I shake my head. Didn't you originally hire me to hunt for people you're searching for? This is what I do.
Except you don't work for me anymore.
He narrows his eyes at me. There's fire in his gaze, but beyond that, I can see fear.
There's nothing holding us together that would make you do this, unless you want something from me.
So what is it, Amika? What do you really want?
He's reading me better than I thought, assuming that because of what he'd done to me, I'm doing the same to him. I'd told him once that I was coming for him, and he hasn't forgotten it.
I'm not hunting you, I say. I'm trying to tell you the truth.
Who are you working for?
He draws closer now, his eyes focused on me with that familiar searing intensity.
Is it Zero? Did someone put you up to this?
He's leaping ahead now, guessing too much. For a moment, I think I've gone back in time to when I'd first met him, when I had to stare him down to prove my worth.
It's not safe to tell you more here, I reply. My voice does not falter under his scrutiny, and I don't look away.
I need to talk to you in private, just the two of us. I can't give you anything more than that.
Hideo's face looks completely closed off. I wonder if he's replaying in his mind every detail from the day that Sasuke went missing, every excruciating moment he lived through afterward. Or maybe he's trying to break this scenario down, puzzling over whether I'm setting a trap for him or not.
I'm not the one who broke our trust, I go on, more softly now. I always told you the truth. I worked faithfully for you, and you lied to me.
You know exactly why I had to do it.
My anger now flares at his stubbornness.
Why'd you lead me on then? I snap, growing angrier with each word.
You could have just stayed away or hired someone else. You could have left me alone instead of pulling me in.
Believe me, I regret nothing more, Hideo snaps back.
His answer startles me, and I forget the retort I already had prepared. He doesn't look like he was ready to say it either, and he turns away from me, looking back toward the museum hall. Peals of laughter come from inside. The sounds echo down to us. I try one more time.
Do you care enough about your brother to believe that maybe, just maybe, I'm telling you the truth? I finally reply.
Do you still love Sasuke or not?
I've never said his brother's name out loud before.
It's this that finally seems to crack through his shield. He winces at my words. For a moment, all I can see is Hideo as a small boy. His terror as he realized his brother was no longer in the park. He spent so many years building up his defenses, and now here I am, ripping right through them with a simple question, forcing Sasuke back into the present. For a while, I think he might refuse me again. I've miscalculated everything in my plans against him and the Black Coats. I've sorely overestimated how well I could control this situation. This is too big a hurdle for me to cross.
Then, Hideo turns back to me. He leans down slightly so that our two silhouettes nearly touch.
Tomorrow, he says in a low voice. Midnight.
Chapter 16. By the time I get back to the hotel, a masquerade parade has broken out in the neighboring district, and cosplayers have spilled over from Harajuku's Takeshita Street onto the sidewalks of Omotesando. People dressed in their most elaborate get-ups, both real and virtual, are walking around while crowds gather along the shop entrances to gawk and admire.
The streets themselves are lit up in virtual neon colors, fading gradually from one team's hues to the next. And each time they shift, a burst of cheers comes from the fans. A closer look tells me that most of the cosplayers are dressed in some variation of the team's outfits from this year's championships. I catch glimpses of their vibrant costumes from my window as I hurry around, changing out of my dress and throwing on my black jeans and sweater. Black gloves go on my hands, fresh socks and sneakers on my feet. My pair of slim knives is tucked inside my boots, while my backpack is filled with my usual supplies, my grappling hook, handcuffs, and stun gun. Finally, I download a randomly generated face to set over my features and pull a new mask over the lower half of my face. I may be running with a fancier crew now, but the familiar ritual and the weight of my old tools feel right, convincing me that I actually know what the hell I'm doing, even as Hideo's words from the banquet earlier whirl around in my head. He looked like I had ripped his heart right out of his chest. "Believe me, I regret nothing more." I scowl and yank harder on my shoelaces. None of this was ever my fault, and he knows it. But my encounter with him has still left me spinning, my mind crowded with all the different emotions that he brings. An incoming message from Zero cuts through my train of thoughts. I startle in the darkness and glance up, half expecting to see him standing there in the middle of my room.
"How was your meeting with Hideo?"
"I managed to get a second one with him," I whisper back, my words transcribing in mid-air before being sent back to him.
"When?"
"Tomorrow night. It'll be private. No public settings." There's a pause, and I wonder whether he or Jax had somehow spied on my earlier conversation already, and whether he's just testing me now to see if I'll tell him the truth.
"Make sure it counts."
Outside, a huge roar goes up as the streets shift to red and gold, the Phoenix Riders' colors. Cars honk in enthusiasm as they drive by.
"It will," I say. No more replies come from him.
I wait a little longer, then sigh and bring up Tremaine's map of the Innovation Institute. I tap on Tremaine's profile to send him a message.
"Hey," I murmur, watching my words appear in my view.
"You still in for tonight?" I wait for a while. There's a bit of static on his end, but nothing more. And when he doesn't respond, I take a look at his profile. He's still online, and his profile is haloed in green. "Hey," I message again. "Blackborn, wake up." Maybe his connection's bad, or maybe he really doesn't want to talk to me anymore, not after everything he spilled to me last night. I unplug my board from its charger, trying not to dwell on what other reasons he might have for being silent. When he still doesn't answer me after a few more messages, I get up and grab my board. Heading to the Institute without Tremaine is probably a bad idea, especially after Taylor's talk with me. At least I'd given something to the Blackcoats, enough to keep them satisfied that I'm doing my job for them. But if I'm going to be meeting Hideo tomorrow, any extra info I find on Sasuke will need to happen tonight. I'm running out of time. I don't leave my hotel through the front door. If Jax is watching me tonight, she'll expect me to go through the main entrance. So instead, I pull out my old cable launcher from my backpack, hook the end onto the balcony railing, then climb over the ledge and leap off. Wind whips my hair up in a stream, but from the outside, no one can see more than a rippling shadow moving along the side of the complex. I squint, shivering in the cold as the cable launcher carries me down, jerking to a halt less than a story from the ground. I release the cable and let myself fall with a soft thud. Then I toss down my board and head in the direction of the Institute. For the first time in a while, I head down into the first subway train I can find. They're still congested at this hour of the night. Salarymen exasperated with all the festivities slowing down their travels jostle past me without sparing so much as a glance, while groups of eager fans clog the trains, each trying to get to some party or Warcross street game happening in the city. Ramen stalls and bakeries lining the station interiors are all still packed, while high-end stores bustle with customers, everyone looking for limited edition championship purses and belts and shoes that will all go away once the Warcross season ends. Alongside the advertisements covering the walls of the station are the virtual figures of two more top players chosen for the closing ceremony. Abeni Lia of Kenya, Titans. Trey Kailio of USA, Winter Dragons. I hold my breath and let myself get lost in the fray, hoping that no one recognizes me through my disguises when we're all pressed together in the trains. I ride a few different subway lines until I feel like I can't even find myself in the midst of all the bodies. If Jax still manages to catch up with me, it'll hopefully take her long enough to give me some time to check out the Institute on my own. Half an hour later, I emerge into the darker, quieter residential streets beyond the outskirts of Tokyo. Here, the virtual overlays diminish into little more than building names in subtle white letters. Curry House, Bakery, Laundry, and the block number I'm currently on, then rows and rows of nondescript house labels. Apartments 14-5-3, Apartments 16-6-2. My board streaks silently through the roads until the homes come to an abrupt end. A solid stone wall wraps around the next block, ending in a security window and a lowered barrier gate. I pull to a stop in front of it. There, looming past an expanse of lawn and fountains, is a large office complex, its main atrium made entirely of glass. My gaze stops on the words engraved into the slab of stone just beyond the barrier gate. The same one that Tremaine had shown me in his photo. Japan Innovation Institute of Technology. The parking lot isn't empty. I see a few black cars here, parked in one corner. My hackles rise at the sight. It's entirely possible that some people are just working late, but something about the cars reminds me of the one I'd ridden in with Jax when she'd first taken me to the Black Coats. Maybe Tremaine is here too. At the thought of him, I do another quick scan of my messages. He's still online, but he hasn't answered me yet. I hesitate for another second before I finally pull my hood on tighter, switch my randomized facial features to a new set, and squeeze past the car barrier. The main entrance is locked, of course. From the outside, it's hard to make out exactly what's past the all-glass front atrium. But it soars at least 3 to 4 floors high, and some kind of dim gradient of colored light is sweeping around inside, from top to bottom. The entire building looks shut down for the night. I glance back at the cars, considering, and then wander away from the main entrance to follow the building's wall. I make my way around the entire complex, looking for a good way in, but everything seems locked down, with no security faults anywhere. I huddle down near a clump of bushes on the side of the main building and bring up Tremaine's maps again, hoping to see some security vulnerability I might have missed. Then I run a search on whether the complex has any online system that I can worm into. Once I'd broken into a closed Manhattan boutique by getting past its security camera's simplistic passwords. But here, I find no weaknesses. What good was coming here if I can't even get inside? I sigh, then poke around the perimeter of the building a second time, looking for what clues I can gather. There are several different buildings connected here. A physics wing, a neuroinformatics wing, a research resources tech center, and several cafes. None of this is new info. I'd seen all of this in my online research on the Institute. I'm about to call it a night, when I suddenly hear the faint sound of footsteps. Ahead of me, one of the side entrance's glass doors slides open, and Jax steps out. She glances over her shoulder for an instant, and her gaze sweeps over the campus. I duck below the bushes surrounding the building. My mind stumbles frantically from one possibility to another, each thought as rapid as my heartbeat. What the hell is she doing in here? Who is she with? Jax probably didn't travel here alone. She's a bodyguard and an assassin,
which means she's either here guarding Zero or Taylor, or she's here on a mission to cop someone.
I count to three under my breath, then dare to peek around the side of the bushes. Several guards have emerged from the building to join her. They're dressed in black, too, and I wonder for a moment if any of them are the same people who'd watched me duel Zero in the dark world. Maybe they're the type of low-level goons you'd hire out of the Kabukicho area in Shinjuku. Jax exchanges a few terse words with them, then heads off toward the far side of the complex at a brisk pace. A couple of the guards follow her, while two others start heading back into the door. I move before I can think everything through. Shoulders hunched, eyes forward. I sneak along the bushes like a shadow, as quickly and silently as I can toward the open door. As the last guard disappears inside the door and it starts to close, I dart forward. I slide into the building's dark interior without a sound, right as the door slides closed. Immediately, I slip into the closest hidden crevice I can find, a row of tall recycle bins, but the guards have already disappeared down the hall. I squeeze my eyes shut for a moment and lean my head back against the wall, then pull down my mask so I can take in some deep gasps of air. A sheen of cold sweat covers my entire body. In my next life, I'm going to be an accountant. Farther down the hall, the guard's footsteps grow steadily fainter. I wait until it's completely silent before I pick myself up and move forward. The building is dark, and no one seems to be on duty. I go until the ceiling starts to get higher, and the sound of my footsteps changes. Then I emerge into the main atrium, and I freeze, my mouth open. The Institute's main lobby could be a museum in itself. The ceiling soars many stories above me, and in the vast space is suspended what I can only call an enormous art sculpture that resembles the electric pulses of a brain, except on a massive scale, extending all the way from the ceiling down to a few feet above the floor. Hundreds of lines of light connect colorful orbs, and as I watch, the lines flash and fade, glow and darken. It's hypnotizing. Other displays are encased behind glass boxes, human-like machines with metal limbs and legs, structures made of thousands of cylinders and circles, all moving in a rhythmic pattern, curtains of light that look like a neon waterfall. For a moment, I forget myself and wander from display to display, awed by the eerie beauty of it. I stop at a large timeline projected against the entirety of one wall. It shows the origins of the Institute, old black and white photos, progressing until the timeline ends on a modern-day image of the current building. Then everything shifts, the photos expanding so that they fill the wall, details printed over each image in white letters before scrolling to the next. Headlines appear filled with praise for the Institute, a center devoted to giving its clients cutting-edge technology, to conducting experiments decades ahead of their time, to the constant advancement of science. The muffled sound of some distant sob cuts through my thoughts. I crouch against the wall on instinct, pushing myself deeper into the shadows. The cry has come from somewhere farther down one of the halls. Something about it seems familiar. I wait. When I don't hear anything else, I leave behind the main atrium and hurry down the hall closest to me. It's too dark in here to see the ceiling now, although the sound of my footsteps tells me how high the space is. Two thin purple neon lines highlight the edges of the floor. Several long minutes drag on. Occasional sounds and voices ringing out. Somewhere ahead of me comes another muffled thud. Then voices I don't recognize. The hall ends abruptly, leading into another enormous space. This time with several brightly lit rooms, covered on all sides with thick glass walls. Inside one room is Zero. I frown. No, it's not Zero. Just something that looks like him. A black metal suit, tall and lean.
its head and body completely encased in armor. A robot? Standing outside the glass room is Zero himself, deep in conversation with Taylor. She has several screens hovering in front of her, all of them only blank white from my view. As Zero talks, she pushes her glasses up on her nose and types onto a screen in mid-air. Her shoulders look fragile in their hunched position. Zero steps away from Taylor toward the glass. She nods at him. And as I look on, he steps right through the glass wall and into the room with his armor. I blink. He's not here in person. He's a virtual simulation. Then where is he? Zero walks around the robot version of himself, inspecting it carefully. A loud beep sounds out from the glass room, and suddenly the robot moves. Zero holds out his hand. The robot moves its limb in the exact same motion. Zero turns his head. The robot turns its head too. Taylor pushes the door open and joins him in the room. She tosses a metal object at the robot, and Zero's hand whips out. The robot does the exact same gesture, catching the object in a perfect grip. I gape. Whatever this robot is for, it's entirely hooked up to Zero's mind, with a level of accuracy that frightens me. The muffled sob I'd heard earlier now comes to me again. This time, I turn to see Jax emerge from the shadows of another hall at the other end of the space, shoving a figure forward until they're both standing before the glass room. As Taylor and Zero step out, Jax forces the figure onto his knees. In an instant, I forget all about the robot. I forget about Zero's virtual self controlling the robot with his mind, and Taylor peering at her screens through her glasses. All that matters is the crouched, trembling figure. His skin washed white from the lights, his hair hanging in sweaty strings, his mouth gagged with a cloth. Tremaine. Jax's words drift to me, her voice echoing in the space. Found him messing with the security cams, she says. He tried making a run for the panic room when he realized I was onto him. Somehow he knew the panic room's system is off the main grid. Zero folds his hands behind his back and observes Tremaine's bowed figure. Sounds like someone has been studying the Institute's blueprints, he replies. Sounds like someone was laying a path out for someone else, Jax adds. He's not here alone. Tremaine shakes his head vigorously. His cheeks gleam wet under the light. I can't swallow. Any sound around me has now faded completely away behind the roar of blood in my ears, and the edges of my vision blur. No wonder Tremaine hadn't responded to any of my messages tonight. He came here after all, and they'd known. Maybe had even been waiting for him. Taylor's words rush back at me. And is that all you did tonight? I'm trying to warn you. I half expect her to step in and help him out, protect him from Jax and Zero. But she stays where she stands, screens still hovering around her. They must have found out Tremaine was the one behind the hack into the Institute's files, that he had passed along the information, maybe even that he'd given it to me. How did they find out? Through me. Maybe they were spying on our conversations. They've hacked into my accounts. Or they might have traced something Tremaine accidentally left behind. Suddenly, I feel a tidal wave of nausea. It's the same feeling I have when I know danger is creeping forward, and all I want to do is push everyone else away from me so it can't hook into any of them. Tremaine has turned his face up to Zero now. Even in his terror, I can see the recognition registering on him. He's never met Zero before, but he knows who he is. Jax leans down and removes Tremaine's gag. Zero asks him something, but Tremaine's lips don't move to respond. All he does is stay silent. Jax's shoulders shift
as she sighs. Zero takes a step forward, but Jax shakes her head and holds a hand up. "Let me," she seems to be saying. She takes her hands off Tremaine.